Good afternoon, everyone. The Senate State and Local Government Committee. What's wrong with this mic? Are they always like that to the side? Oh, isn't that weird? Oh, there we go. The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. We have an ambitious agenda today, so we're going to try to move very quickly. I would just like to welcome everyone who is in the audience and ask you, if you make your comments, if you could really try hard not to be too repetitive or duplicative. I know everyone has made an effort to be here today, and we really appreciate you coming, but as I said, this is supposed to be the unsession. We're moving very quickly, and we have a long agenda. So welcome, Senator Saxhog, Senate File 1919.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 1919, and I have the A1 amendment that I would like to have offered at this time to get the bill in the shape I desire.
There's someone on the committee who would like to offer that A1 amendment.
So moved.
Senator Scalzi offers the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill will make minor changes to the state's procurement statutes to ensure that when public entities are hiring construction contractors, they are hiring contractors who follow the law.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Did someone move the bill to begin with?
We don't do that in the Senate.
Oh, okay.
That's a House custom.
Reflection back in.
Yeah. Sorry. Did you come from the House? Yeah, it is confusing. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you. So this bill will make some minor changes in the state's procurement statutes to ensure that when public entities are hiring construction contractors, they're hiring contractors who follow the law. When most construction contractors follow the rules, those who skirt the law in order to win bids cost taxpayers money and get an unfair advantage. In the bidding process, Senate File 1919 aims to fix this problem. With me today, and I'm assuming they're coming up, Tammy Wild with the Minnesota Fair Contracting Foundation, Harry Melander of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, and Kyle Macarios, Director of Governmental Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. And they will explain the bill in more detail and answer any questions.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wild.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Tammy Wild, and I'm Compliance Legal Counsel with the Fair Contracting Foundation of Minnesota, or FCF. In 2007, the recession was devastating to the construction industry. Unlawful employment practices became rampant in construction, both nationwide and in Minnesota. In 2010, the industry was at its lowest point in a generation. In 2011, the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades established the Fair Contracting Foundation, and within 2 years, FCF was adopted and funded by hundreds of Minnesota construction contractors through nine contractor associations. Now FCF is a labor management cooperative committee formed under the Federal Labor Management Cooperation Act of 1978. At FCF, we advocate for practices, policies, and laws that ensure fair government contracts, a strong local industry, and protection of the public interest. I'm here to share what we've learned about the protection of the public interest on Minnesota's public construction projects. And here are just a few examples of the projects that FCF filed with the appropriate enforcement agencies since its inception. In 2012, a large Minnesota State Colleges and Universities construction project at the North Hennepin Community College produced documented evidence of wage violations that were shared with our Department of Labor and Industry. At the time, DLI found four of the contractors had wage violations on the state project totaling approximately $23,000. Beyond the four one of the subcontractors on that job was also the prime focus of a federal wage and hour investigation on a federally funded project in Woodbury the year before. And that subcontractor was responsible for the majority of the $370,000 of federal wage violations on the Woodbury project. Beyond the four contractors on the North Hennepin project, there was a fifth contractor. Our Attorney General decided to commence legal action against this fifth contractor, and the case was just recently resolved after investigation and litigation, recovering another $54,000 for underreporting hours and misclassification of workers, totaling $77,000 of vendor violations on one project alone. Our cities have seen the same problem. One FCF investigation led the City of St. Paul to recover over $48,000 and seek its first debarment in 10 years. The case settled short of debarment, but the same contractor was found with identical violations on state DNR and state historical society projects the following year. Our public schools might have even greater problems. One of our first investigations found bricklayers being paid cash under the table on an elementary school that was being built as if it were part of an underground economy. When confronted with the allegations, the subcontractor abandoned the project and disappeared overnight. Finally, an affluent Western Metro school district allowed their public funds to compensate a subcontractor whose owners had existing state and federal tax liens under their prior business name. These are just six examples of the scores of cases that we have investigated and filed during the two calendar years that FCF has been in existence. The year 2011 had been the Department of Labor and Industry's highest year for prevailing wage violation recoveries. But in 2012, the Department of Labor and Industry recorded a 270% increase in dollars recovered, and the number of cases actually doubled. The examples I've referenced here are supported by public documents. They are objective findings or actual developments of serious contractor misconduct. But now I'm just going to talk a little bit about my day-to-day experience at FCF. I speak to public project managers, and I see that they afford construction contractors ample opportunity to correct problems like payroll errors, safety deficiencies, and work quality issues before ever taking formal steps to seek compliance with the law. These same public project managers become frustrated when a relatively small number of non-compliant contractors are awarded their projects time and time again. The story I often hear is that these non-compliant contractors are repeatedly hired for public work because they are the low bidder, and the government agency representatives think they are obliged to hire the lowest bidder. This is not true under the law, but the word responsible has become almost meaningless over time because there is precious little guidance on how to interpret it. This Senate bill offers help in that regard. The Fair Contracting Association appreciates the time and attention that you're giving the standards that we should expect for our responsible contractors on public construction projects in our state. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Wild? And Mr. Melander.
Sure, thank you. Chair Pappas, members of the committee, my name is Harry Melander. I work at the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council as their chair. Our community of builders is 55,000 strong and growing, partly due to the good work that you have done in previous sessions, putting Minnesotans back to work, and we thank you for that. Today we are here to comment on Senate File 1919, a bill we believe, as you should, that Minnesota wants businesses that use our money to be responsible with it and to make sure only businesses that play by the rules are given opportunities to prosper as private businesses using public dollars. We believe that this bill will give assurances for contracting authorities and municipalities that do not exist within our current public bidding practices. Responsible contractors will provide contracting authorities and municipalities a new tool to support the type of businesses that we value in Minnesota. Fair, registered, insured, valid tax ID numbers, and individuals that have complied, have not had non-compliance with workers regarding compensation matters. Public dollars should benefit our private business partners. We should want to make sure that those individuals that benefit from public dollars comply with the laws that you've created. responsible Minnesotans, responsible contractors should not have an issue with this bill. This bill is very simple to understand. We are asking you as our lawmakers to ensure that we as taxpayers and beneficiaries of dollars that go to contracting authorities, that they can verify that contractors or their subcontractors comply simply with the law. Simply a one-page affidavit that would allow contractors and subcontractors a choice, which should be they have not had a violation that would be considered a break of the law prior to this bid award. And if they had, they must disclose it. This should not be an issue for any responsible contractor in Minnesota, and they should not object to it. Yet today you will hear from individuals that this creates more paperwork, more government, that there will be less of an incentive for individuals to bid on jobs, and that there will be unintended consequences because of this bill. Chair, committee members, that's not our intent. We simply believe that individuals that benefit, private individuals that benefit from public dollars, should abide by the law. Now, what I will do is I will pass it on to Kyle Makarios, unless you have questions to me, which will go through briefly the bill itself. And thank you for your time.
Any questions, Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Molander, so according to this new amendment that they put on, this will include a school district in outstate Minnesota that is wanting to add on to or build a new school. They will be required to pay prevailing wage on these people that are going to be putting up a bill out there.
Senator Pappas, Senator Anderson, that's not the case. What the bill states is that we are asking the Senate and the House to pass a bill that would require individuals to, on a simple one-page affidavit, that they haven't had a violation in regards to those statutes that are spelled out within the bill. It has nothing to do with prevailing wages.
Senator Anderson, anything else?
I disagree.
Okay, Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And Senator Anderson, maybe I can elaborate on that when I'm finished kind of running through the bill, but be glad to address that point. My name is Kyle Makarios. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Carpenters Union here in Minnesota. We've heard kind of what the problem is and what the goal of the bill is to ensure that public entities, when going on the market for construction services and thinking about what contractors to hire, what kind of contractors to hire, operate more like a business. And that is that when a business decides what kind of contractor to hire for construction, they're not going to decide to hire a contractor that didn't follow the rules the last time they hired them. And so what we're asking is that the public entities take that same approach. If a contractor violates the law, our own laws about how we operate in the construction industry, the taxpayer should think twice about hiring that contractor. Here's how this bill will attempt to help the situation. Contractors that bid on work from state or local government will have to sign a statement under oath that they meet a set of minimum criteria. All of these criteria are in current law. They'll have to verify that they comply with and have not had any recent major violations of laws, such as requirements to pay for workers' compensation and unemployment insurance, and to have a tax ID number. They can't have had major violations of a series of wage and hour laws, including overtime, child labor, and prevailing wage requirements. They can't have violated a municipality's requirement for payment of wages on a recent contract. They must abide by laws prohibiting illegal subcontracting schemes, payroll fraud, and employee misclassification. They can't have current tax liens. They can't have operated under a false front as a disadvantaged business. And they can't be currently debarred by the federal government, the state, or any local government. That is the essence of this bill. A contractor would simply have to certify that they meet these minimum criteria, all of which are in current law. We tried very hard to craft this bill so that there's very minimal administrative burden on either legitimate employers or on any public agency. Contractors simply have to sign a statement that they meet the criteria, and public agencies only have to accept it. If it turns out that a contractor submits a false statement, then they're in breach of contract and are ineligible to work on public contracts for 3 years. We recognize, committee members and Madam Chair, that we haven't quite achieved peace in the valley on this bill yet. There is still work going on. We're working very hard with a number of contractor associations to address concerns that they've brought to us, primarily concerning inadvertent mistakes not triggering this, right? So if a contractor makes inadvertent mistakes, they should still be able to bid on public projects. And we are trying to find thread that needle and make sure we are keeping the intentional lawbreakers off of our taxpayer taxpayer-funded projects while also making sure we're not providing any penalty to contractors who inadvertently violate the law. With that, Madam Chair, I will gladly take any questions.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Makarios, you already said that this situation is already in present law. So the thing that you're doing is you're asking for these individuals that are going to bid on public projects to sign a application stating that they meet the requirements that are already in statute. So you're adding more language to the law that doesn't really need to be there. All you need is a piece of paper saying that they're going to abide by the law that's already in statute.
Mr. Makarios.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think that if I understand your question right, that you're right. I mean, all we're asking is we're not changing any of the basic law. What we're doing is asking a contractor to certify that they meet all of these existing laws before we award a contract to them, before the taxpayers award a contract to them.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Makarios, who's going to be overseeing this? If not, if the DOLI are not overseeing this, then who else is going to be overseeing this to make sure that the application that was signed and documented is going to be adhered to?
Mr. Makarios.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, a question we grappled with and the approach we're taking with this bill, rather than create a new bureaucracy and figure out a way to fund it and staff investigators to go out on job sites and verify this compliance, our thought here is that this is the there will be no – the short answer is there will be no enforcing agency for these. A public entity will have an affidavit, a sworn statement from a contractor that they meet the law. If it turns out that contractor is lying, they're taking a significant risk by lying on that sworn statement. And so what we're hoping is that the deterrent effect of signing a sworn statement saying that we don't violate these laws – and the potential penalty of not being eligible to bid on public contracts will help the industry self-correct or help contractors who engage in these kind of business practices to decide that they don't want to work on our taxpayer-funded projects.
All right. Any other questions? Then why don't we move on to Mr. Marquis.
Thank you.
You can correct me if I mispronounce your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, my name is Matt Marquis.
Marquis. Not the S.
Yes, French pronunciation. Mm-hmm. I'm here representing over 70 different subcontractors involved in the drywall, painting, asbestos abatement, mechanical insulation, and floor covering industries. These subcontractors support the concept of the bill, but they do not support the language that is currently before you. They acknowledge that there is a need to have responsible contractors bidding on prevailing work, a lot of the work which they do in this state. But we're still working with the building trades and other interested parties to come to a resolution on a due process and appeal process for subcontractors and also this inadvertent language.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, may I ask a question?
Senator Hall, please.
Sir, I didn't get your name. I'm sorry.
Marquis.
Mm-hmm. So there is not a process right now in the bill to appeal this? Is that what you're telling me?
No, Mr. Marquis.
Madam Chair, excuse me, Senator. What is in process right now, if you look at the Delete All Amendment, under Department of Labor and Department of Transportation, there are processes for orders to comply. I believe it's an informal process, and that's a farther step down the road. What we're more concerned about is local units of government, what kind of process there would be involved in that area.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Who, introduce yourself, please, for the committee.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm an interloper, but my name is Gary Thaden. I represent two construction trade associations. It's THADEN. I represent the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, who do plumbing, heating, and air conditioning work. And I also represent the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association. Between those two, we've got over 300 contractors who work throughout and are located throughout the state of Minnesota. We support the basic approach of this bill. We do have some concern about isolated parts of it, including the procedural aspect that was just discussed, and also the $10,000 amount. But we do support the basic approach to this bill, and we think this would be a vast improvement in the construction industry in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary, what's the last name again?
Thaden, T-H-A-D-E-N.
Mr. Thaden, do you know from the Department of Labor and Industry how many contractors have violated this statute that's already in law?
There are a number of statutes, Madam Chair, Senator. There are a number of statutes in here that are referenced that are governed by the Department of Labor and Industry. It's wage and hour laws, it's prevailing wage, OSHA, and some others that I don't know off the top of my head. So I really have no idea how many people have violated all of those statutes.
But, Madam Chair, Mr. Thaden, you know of people that supposedly have violated it, and the Department of Labor and Industry have prosecuted these people.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Is there anyone here from Labor and Industry?
Madam Chair, Mr. Rakowski.
I'm sorry, Mr.
Rakowski just stepped out, I believe.
Oh,
he's sitting right over here.
Okay. Well, if he comes back, we can ask him. All right. Any other questions for Mr. Thaden or Mr. Markey? Then let's take the next two, Mr. Werke and Mr. Becker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke, W-O-R-K-E. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're the association that represent the majority of the signatory union contractors, about 80 to 85% of my members on the highway and vertical construction market are union contractors. I'm here today to also echo some of the sentiments you've already heard, but mainly to point out for you and tell you that we agree with the underlying tenets of this bill. We think it's important that everyone play by the same set of rules from a competitiveness standpoint. And we're also interested in furthering that objective. Some of the concerns that you've heard, I'm not going to reiterate again. We have the similar concerns, but we are working very hard and very closely with our partners in the union market to address those concerns, principally the administrative burden, degree of the accountability provisions, the debarment provision, and then some of the questions about the administrative inconsistency that may be there and the unintended consequences. But I'm going to defer some of my time here and let Mr. Becker address a few things. But I want to assure the committee that we are working closely with the folks that would like to see this bill pass to make sure that we end up with a good product that everybody can support.
Thank you very much. And this bill will be going to transportation policy from here. So it has a few committee stops. Mr. Becker.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Becker, and I'm an attorney with the Fabianski, Westra, Hart & Thompson law firm. We represent a lot of union contractors. And so we've been asked by the AGC to take a look at this bill and provide some comments for their use. And say I don't want to repeat what others have said, but the two things that we've looked at are the one, the due process issue. For example, in subpart 3 of subdivision 3, it defers to the municipality to determine whether there's a violation. Oftentimes, the determination of whether there's a violation of a wage law can be in dispute, and so it doesn't provide any information in this statute for exactly how that determination should go. Is there an opportunity for the contractor to present its side of the case, for example, would be some of the due process protections we would want to see in this bill. And so that's just one important example, and we're working with the proponents of the bill to try to iron that out. The other thing I'd want to address and draw to your attention is the basis for the penalty, which is debarment, a very severe penalty for contractors, is a false certification. And so based on the way the statute is written, there isn't any difference in the degree to which a particular statement might be false. It's a strict liability standard. I think we're all familiar with the concept of an outright lie. I think we can all agree that that wouldn't be a good thing. And so an outright lie on an affidavit would certainly be something that should be subject to the debarment penalty. However, because of the complicated legal basis for which we could give rise to this, I mean, there's a lot of different particular statutes that are involved that could give rise to a debarment penalty. There's often shades of gray where a contractor might have an interpretation of whether they've complied with that's in every respect in good faith ultimately turns out to be not correct. But there was certainly no intention to deceive anyone or to make a statement that was without due regard for the facts. So that's kind of where we're seeing where some changes could be made to this law to improve it so that we're not punishing an innocent misrepresentation that turns out to be false and causing a contractor to lose their entire business. And even one where they use reasonable care and it turns out to be false. So those are the kind of issues that we're seeing with the bill and hope to work with others to make the bill even better than it is.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Becker, in this new amendment that was put on, it shows there's a definition for a contractor. And then it goes to page 2, and now it says it's a responsible contractor. And in state law, I'm guessing that it's just contractor right now. And I was already told that by one of the testifiers that this is just a replication of present law. What's the difference between a contractor and a responsible contractor from a legal standpoint?
Yeah.
Mr. Becker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. Traditionally, there's been a distinction in the law on two components of a low bid. Each contractor has to be evaluated for its responsibility as well as its responsiveness. The responsiveness would be, did the contractor's bid meet the specifications? Did they provide a price? Did they agree to build whatever project was contemplated? And the responsibility would focus on things like, has the contractor been convicted of crimes? Are there debarred in the state? Things like that. So there already are some laws on the books that deal with whether a contractor is responsible or not. So what this particular statute does, in my view, is it kind of provides more standards that a contractor would have to meet the definition of responsible. So I think it kind of expands the test of responsibility for a contractor.
Okay, no more questions, then why don't we ask Mr. Raines to come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and members. My name is Phil Raines. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I appreciate you taking the time to look at this. I fully appreciate what the thrust of this bill is. There are many bad actors out there that certainly need to be taken off. One statement that I think needs to be clarified out there is that this simply applies existing law to people that are out there. That's true for the majority of it. However, there is a redefinition of a prevailing wage violation under this. Under current statute, we already have a debarment. It's actually rule, not statute. But I looked up on the department's website, and there are about 17 people debarred right now. There is a possibility for doing this for a willful or repeated violation. All of the examples that were put forward earlier in testimony appear on the scant evidence we have here that they were willful or repeated violations. In those situations, those people should be debarred. If you're going out to beat the system, you definitely should be. However, if you make a voluntary back payment of $10,000 or more, you would be debarred under this bill. And I can tell you from talking to my contractors and having sat in on some of the administrative hearings on these, very often the case is someone has made a calculation error, someone has made a classification error, or there's a difference of opinion about what the classification could be. I know of one specific case where one of our fine state agencies had one of our contractors installing metal door, hollow metal doors, had a whole crew doing that, and he had carpenters doing that, which is traditionally the way they're done. However, there was a dispute, and the department said that they should have been iron workers doing that. Those who've been in the trades have heard this argument before, and iron worker generally knows how to put together big pieces of iron, but they don't know how to put together a lock and frame up a door so that it's true and fits properly. It was a crazy allegation. In this situation, they totaled up a lot of these allegations, put together a list, and said that the contractor owed back wages of $117,000. The guy is actually one of my heroes because he made a really poor business decision, and he said, "I'm going to fight it." He fought it for over 9 years at a cost of over $300,000 to him. Administrative law judge looked into it, basically said the claims were baseless that were thrown at him. Ended up having the suit dropped in the end. The guy lost $200,000 on the deal. Like I said, he's kind of one of my heroes because he really made a poor business decision, but he stood on principle and he said, "I'm not going to do it." In most situations that come forward like this, I got to tell you, the contractors make the business decision and say, "We're going to just write the check. You know, it's going to cost me more in legal fees than it's going to take to fight it, so I'm going to send it out." And they do that regularly. In this situation, I think it's working for the state in a lot of ways because the workers get their checks very quickly under this. Whether it's justified or not, they get their payments quickly. And our guys are responsible contractors out there. We have guys that pay well over the prevailing wage rate on the check and think that's the right thing to do. But oftentimes they get caught up in these situations and they just simply write a check and move forward. They're in the business of contracting. And under this scenario, with the $10,000 violation, they would have to fight all of it all along the way. So what you're going to see is actually an increase in department costs that come along with this because there is going to be increased litigation that comes with it because the contractor's fighting for what is essentially their company. If they were to be debarred, would be forced to fight every allegation that comes forward instead of writing the check out.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Raines. Appreciate your comments. Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Raines, these 17 contractors that you said are debarred, are they no longer contractors? Was it technicalities or was it, did they actually, was it the Department of Labor and Industry that filed the suit or who? I mean, you just mentioned that they shouldn't be contracting anymore. So are they no longer in the state of Minnesota? Have they been put in behind bars or what?
Mr. Raines.
I only know some of the situations that are out there when I looked into these. Some of them are for people lying to the state, lying on affidavits. I don't know the extent of all of them. There were several trucking organizations that came under them.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Raines, you made a reference to changing the current prevailing wage law through this legislation or altering it in some way. Could you explain that, please?
Oh, absolutely. On line 3.1 of the DE amendment, or the A1 amendment here, if you look at section 3 right at the top, that is changing the definition of a violation of prevailing wage there. This creates a new consequence for it. There are already significant consequences for the prevailing wage law in terms of daily fines. Every day you're not in compliance. I can't repeat it at the moment. There is a significant daily fine that goes with every day you're out of compliance.
Senator Saxon, did you want to respond to that, or did Mr. Makarios want to?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Makarios probably should.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Thompson, I think I respectfully disagree with Mr. Raines about his interpretation of this. We're certainly not changing the prevailing wage statute. Obviously, this is in the state procurement statute, not in the chapter that deals with prevailing wage. What we are trying to say is the state, we are referencing that a contractor who makes a serious violation, over $10,000 of prevailing wage, on another project, would not be able to certify that they're responsible when they're applying for a new taxpayer-funded project.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Mr. Makarios, the $10,000 seems to be, in some respects, small, and in other respects, maybe large, depending upon the size of the construction. Would it be better, or have you talked that through, about having a percentage or something like that?
Mr. Makarios.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, I think you've hit the proverbial nail on the head here in terms of the issue that we're wrestling with here. How do you set a bar that will eliminate people who are gaming the system but not eliminate people who make technical errors? We're having a lot of discussion about this very topic right now with a lot of the folks that testified earlier. I think this is the real meat of what we need to really figure out as this bill moves forward.
We do have a technical correction on page 1, line 20. Senate Counsel has suggested after the word town that we insert home rule charter or statutory. And Senator Eaton moves that change. Everybody have it?
Mm-hmm.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. All right, Senator Saxog, any final comments? Someone want to move the bill
Madam
for him?
No, Madam Chair, I think that it's been fairly obvious that though most people that have come up to this table agree with the law or the purpose of the law, that there are some things that need to be worked out, and that's why we're going through the committee process. And with that, Madam Chair, I would like to have this bill as amended moved and sent to the Transportation Committee.
Before we take, we need a motion for that, Senator Thompson.
Yeah, I have spoken with Mr. Makarios, I've spoken with Mr. Raines, and this is one of those bills to me that is not about some large philosophical problem. It's a bill about regulation of industry. Obviously, all of us want to see people compete fairly and play by the rules. It just seems to me it's one of those things that if we gave the parties a little bit of time, maybe they could work through this thing, and to use Mr. Makarios' phrase, that there could be peace at the valley or peace in the valley on, mm-hmm. on these things. And I would just ask that the chair consider that, to ask the parties to take a little bit more time to work something out.
Absolutely, Senator Thompson. I think that was the intention. Many Mr. Makarios said that. Many of the testifiers said that they did support the intent, and the devil was in the details. And this is going to transportation, so I think there'll be time for them to work that out. So hopefully by the time it gets to the floor, we'll have unanimous vote. Who knows? Can I move it?
I'd like to move.
All right. Senator Eaton moves that Senate Bill 1919 is amended, be recommended to pass. Any more discussion? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, did the Department of Labor and Industry, did the representative come back in?
I guess he did. And why don't you join the table? I'll set the table. And the question was about the number of violations, I believe. Was that the question?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, John Rakuski, the Legislative Director for Labor and Industry. We've been working with the Department of Administration and MnDOT and the advocates for the bill for several weeks, and we were asked that question. I'm sorry I didn't hear the question, but you're talking about the number of violators who would be affected by this law, not just the total number, right?
I'm looking at the total number that you've prosecuted or that the Department of Labor has had jurisdiction in bringing these. As Mr. Raines said, there were 17 contractors that were debarred. How many total are we talking about?
Well, I
Mr.
don't
Kowski.
Have that number, Madam Chair. Representative.
Senator.
There's a lot of former representatives over there. Senator, I can tell you that we looked at the number that would fall under this $10,000 threshold, if that would be helpful, and it's about 37, roughly right around there, contractors that would be affected by this law if it were by this bill if it were law today. And as the bill was presented yesterday morning, we've just been looking at it from a state agency standpoint, but the bill, has an impact on every level of government, from cities to townships, and we don't have that number.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After listening to the debate here and meeting with both of the parties, kind of getting to what Senator Hall had talked about. It seems like it may be appropriate, as you guys are looking at this, to provide maybe a little bit of, I don't want to use the term inherent authority, but similar to that, to the people who are putting the bids out and making the determinations. It seems to me that part of the problem is we've got this hard and fast rule that says lowest responsible bidder, and we take the decision-making capability away from that local entity. And I understand the reasons why that exists, but maybe there's a middle ground where they do it within the confines of a range of requirements rather than saying hard and fast, lowest responsible bidder. And then that way we can provide local authorities with some more discretion as it relates to decision-making, again, within some reasonable parameters rather than just a mandatory lowest responsible bidder kind of statement. So that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Then Senator Eaton renews her motion that Senate Bill 1919 is amended to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Then it has to go to Jobs and Judiciary. So there is plenty of time for more discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Sieben. Senator Saxhog, Senator Sieben is next on the schedule, but can you wait a minute? Okay, Senator Saxhog, let's take your second bill then.
All right, thank you very much. Madam Chair, members, thank you for your attention on the last bill. This bill is Senate File 1807, and I have an A3 amendment I'd like to have to put this bill in the shape I desire. A3 amendment.
While that's being passed out, Senator Saxhog, do you want to just tell us a little bit about the bill? And then we'll take your author's
sure.
amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Interest of time.
This bill came to me from the Lieutenant Governor, who had been working with the First Lady of the United States and Dr. Jill Biden to help military members, their spouses, and recently discharged veterans who moved to a new state to gain employment in a field that might require a license. We're only one of five states in the country that has not done anything in this regard. And you should have a one-page handout in your information that has most of the information that you probably will need for the scope of this bill. We are before your committee today because this bill relates to the Board of Cosmetology, the Board of Accountancy, and the Board of Barbers, and the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Land Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design, which all fall under your jurisdiction. My office has spoken with the directors of each board, and they are supportive of the bill at this time and willing to work with me through the next three potential policy stops to make sure that we do it properly. Many boards already have the ability to do this and have everything in place. I'm working with all the stakeholders to make sure that we can establish a process for expediting applications and issuing temporary licenses. With me today is Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of the Military, to give brief testimony and help answer any questions that the committee might have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Sachs. Why don't we do the amendment? Senator Scalzi moves the A4 amendment that's been passed out. Looks like just some technical changes, like taking out each. it's such that we want to take out. Sorry. All those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
Director
members
Kerr.
Of the committee. I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill. The agency supports the bill, not for advantage that it will give to our current members or their families, but as we see the downsizing, the active component coming, this will assist in the transition of folks off active duty into Minnesota, many of whom are already participating in these trades and skills that in other states, and this will help ease their transition into life in Minnesota while still maintaining the high standards that our licensing agencies in Minnesota maintain.
And there's a lot of talent in our military forces that can be put to work in Minnesota. So that's great. It's a great idea. Any questions for Senator Saxog or Director Kerr? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerr, and this bill, is the military member not supposed to provide a DD-214? I don't see anything of a requirement for showing that they are an active duty member.
Director Kerr.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I guess I'm not sure about how the technical piece, I believe that would be left to rulemaking within the individual licensing agencies to establish the procedure. I believe the bill refers to directing the agencies to establish the procedures to issue temporary licenses as opposed to what the actual requirement is for military members. I would then expect that in rulemaking, those agencies that have licensing authority would require that proof of military service in order to grant such license.
Madam Chair, and
Senator Saxon
and Senator Anderson, you know, the primary goal of this particular statute or law would be to have the boards defined in this bill and establish their own process for expediting applications and issuing the temporary licenses. So we're really leaving a lot of setting the qualifications and how long they're going to issue the temporary licenses for. We're leaving that with each one of the boards that's in charge of this.
Any other questions? Anyone else here to testify on this bill? All right, then, Senator Scalzi, is that okay? Moves that Senate File 1807 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on
Health and Human Services.
Oh. We have... Because of the health licensing boards? You don't care? I mean, it has to go to any of them. Okay, and be sent to the Policy Committee on Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Oh, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Great, motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now, Senator Sieben. Senator Conan here? Otherwise, we can send for Senator Carlson. He is here. Okay, great. Senator Sieben, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 2076 was brought to me by, this piece of legislation was brought forth by Dakota County, which I would suggest is continuing its track record of efficient and effective government and ways that it can best be stewards of taxpayers' money. So we were told, the Dakota County delegation, that as part of the annual budget process, the county undertook a process to identify ways to streamline and become more efficient in their operations. They reduced the county's full-time employee count by over 130 positions and cut budgeted spending by nearly $40 million annually. What else came about from these streamlining efforts was the board decided to examine its own governance and citizen advisory committees, and a number of changes were recommended as a result of that study, and some of those recommended changes are now before us in Senate File 2076. So the legislation essentially would allow the county to make changes to its citizen advisory committees to better streamline and become more efficient. I have been told, and you members of this committee probably know this, that there are essentially three different ways that a county can govern itself. either by a county manager position, a county executive position, which is what Dakota County now has, or Ramsey County is the only county that has a charter county style of government. And so this proposal would move Dakota County to a county manager position. So here today to discuss more of the need for the legislation is Senator or Commissioner, former Senator, now Commissioner Chris Gerlach.
Welcome, Commissioner Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members.
And this used to be your committee room when you were the chair.
It was. I'm intimidated. I will say I do have a suggestion for the Rules Committee that we really should have alumni parking passes. I don't know how we could approve, but I realized driving up here that I couldn't park in front. Well, members, thank you, and glad to be here. As you know, I can't take credit for many of the accomplishments that Dakota County has done over the past years, having just joined the board in this past year, but I have been significantly impressed by a lot of the forward thinking, a lot of the just hands-on management in making it a better place. And I'm just lucky to be part of that organization. And one of those ongoing refinements is what you have before you today. And really, the meat of the bill before you is allowing Dakota County to have some broader control over the advisory committees. This is really what this is about. As you know, the state statute creates counties, and in many of the different silos, whether it's Community Corrections Advisory Board or the Human Services Advisory Committee or the Library Board or many of the wide array of these, we want to be able to structure those and modify those so that they best suit our needs. But as you know, you've just, the Senate or the legislature has just undergone a complete study of all of the advisory boards and commissions that are at the state level, and you've come to the conclusion that there are some outdated, some modifications need to be made, those sorts of things. We've done the same thing, but the difference for us is we need your permission to do that. Now, we could come to all of the various committees and do these one by one by one, or there is a simpler way to do that, and that is come before you and just making some modifications to the form of government that the county has that will allow us to do that. As Senator Sieben said, so that is the main thing. Then as long as we're under the hood, so to speak here, we might as well take a look and say, you know what, we have over the decades, the county has delegated through administrative procedures, has done it through special laws and statutes of various changes to the way that our county administrator form of government operates, that we have moved down towards more county manager, but there's still some pieces out there, not all of it, but we want to be able to pick and choose those things that work best for us, that will professionalize the way we do our business, that will modernize the way we do our business. So we might as well take care of that as well. So that's the nuts and bolts of the bill. I could certainly go on about a lot of the differences that we're talking about with some of the possible advisory committee changes, modifying some of the term limits, taking a look at some of the residency requirements on boundaries that maybe don't make sense for us that we would like to try to tweak. Also making probably the biggest one is the library board. You know, historically, library boards have been separate silos at county government. But over the years, more and more counties have realized that it's not the best management practice, that library boards ought to be advisory rather than having the budget and spending authority, because you may not know, it's been Dakota County. We have 9 libraries. We have about 100, almost 150 employees and about a $12 million budget. And statute allows a library board that is appointed by the county board, but they have wide latitude, and I would say too much latitude, in how that money is spent without the direct oversight of a county board that is elected in spending those dollars. So you've seen other people bring legislation before you from different counties over the years. In fact, Hennepin, Scott, Washington, Carver counties have already made this change. And I believe recently you had Blue Earth County in this committee that you had approved a change on their library board to make that advisory. So those are the types of things that we're trying to accomplish with this. I can certainly answer any other questions for members, but that's the bill in a nutshell.
Any questions for Commissioner Gerlach or Senator Sieben? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Gerlach, just curious, I had the library people in my office twice today. How would they feel about that kind of change in terms of oversight?
Sure. Well, the good news is, Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, is that we have a very good and positive working relationship with our county library board. Sometimes you've come across some counties that maybe don't have that, and they are maybe having disputes over territory or authority and different management or maybe who the library director is or those sorts of things. When you get into that kind of a situation, that is not the time to propose changing the structure, because people will dig in their heels, and it's not a collaborative way. What we're doing is we have a positive working relationship, and we're looking ahead to say, you know what, we could get in trouble down the road, so let's do this in an environment where it is more collaborative. And our library board certainly has been briefed on this, and although I'm sure some are saying, you know, I would like to keep it the way it is, there's also some that are saying, well, this makes some sense. But there's no large outcry. I think that it's somewhat common sense to most of them.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Mr. Gerlach, I'm just wondering, other than the library board, what are some specific committees that might be altered, and how so would they be altered under this type of change?
Mr. Gerlach.
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi, one thing we would like to do is, for example, outdated committees. The Community Corrections Advisory Board is one. When Dakota County became a Community Corrections Act county back in the, I think it was the 1980s, late 1980s, there was a very positive role for an advisory board as you integrate the different corrections programs in with the community. But now, as that has matured over 25 years, we've found that there's no real need. And it's one of those that's there that if you were to look, you say, why do we really, you know, we don't really need this anymore. We're up and running. We're running a good program. And it's time to maybe decide maybe that we don't need to put our effort into that. So we'd be looking at the potential elimination of the Community Corrections Advisory Board. I think that our Human Service Advisory Committee is working fine. We don't have any thoughts on changes for that one. We would like to look at aligning the terms of our Planning Commission members to fit better with some cycles and some things we're doing. But again, would require legislative changes. We would like to be able to do that. Now, of course, we would not be making any changes to any of the quasi-judicial boards, for example, anything substantively to the Planning Commission, which is a quasi-judicial board, or also the zoning board the zoning board, the personnel board of appeals, zoning board of adjustments, what I was thinking. Those are the three that are the quasi-judicial ones. We're not making any changes to any of those. This is more of the true advisory ones. Those are a couple of examples of some things we'd like to be able to do.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I would just add that in talking with Commissioner Gerlach earlier and some of the other folks from Dakota County, they explained how some of the advisory committees have really prescriptive language about where members from those committees either need to come from geographically or represent specific communities. And oftentimes now they're finding they can't even find anybody who's willing to fit into that role. So they want to have the latitude to be able to adjust the advisory committee to meet the you know, be more efficient in that they don't have just these seats that are empty because they can't find anybody to fill them.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ray.
Thank you. I don't know if my microphone is working, but
yes, it is.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Senator Stephen or Commissioner Gerlach, have you had a community process to present this idea? This is not my county, but these are community advisory committees, and I would hate to be in a position to make a decision as to how community input is going to be handled. And I'm not going to say restricted, but it sounds like it's going to be restricted. And an outcome of this decision could be that the commissioners say the legislature made this decision, and we are going to do all of these community decisions. on your behalf because the legislature has given permission for us to do this, and I'm kind of reluctant to accept that kind of responsibility because I am so pro community input. So I don't want to be put in a position where commissioners are providing an excuse for restricting community input based on a legislative decision. So I want to leave that on the record and would like to get an answer for that.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Reid, and you're exactly right in that widespread community involvement in any governmental and public decisions is important. And I think the effect is going to be exactly opposite of what your concern is. For example, just a couple of weeks ago, we have a regional park in Dakota County called Lebanon Hills Regional Park. And we are working on a development of a new master plan. We had a lot of community folks that said we want a greater input on that development, and we want it on the ground floor rather than coming in at the middle. So we stopped our process, and we backed up, and we said, yeah, we agree with that. So we just initiated a process where we're going to be involving dozens of people from the community, from the countywide, in the development of this master plan because we need their buy-in. We need their input. So and we're able to do that locally, and we recognize the need for that. Another aspect is that sometimes we can get citizen input not necessarily from the same model that we have been following for decades, which is get a group of people appointed from certain areas and sit them down in a room and pay them a per diem and have them have staff presentations and then give us some thoughts. With technology and the ability to use social media and various other things, there are oftentimes better ways to get broader citizen involvement far in excess of what our current tunnel vision model is. So we have every thought of not just eliminating things, but modifying them and making them better, making them more robust in some cases, and finding better ways through uses of technology to involve more citizens. So that's our intent.
Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify on this bill and get to sign up? Then does anyone want to make a motion? Senator Johnson moves that Senate Bill 2076, no amendments, be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Any other discussion? Thank you very much. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Committee.
Welcome back, Senator Gerlach.
Yes. Thank you.
Commissioner Gerlach. I'd like to take up Senator Carlson's bill, Senate File 1595. So we do have some witnesses. We have the Mayor of Burnsville who's joining us, and appreciate her taking the time to come down here, but I'm sure she's a very busy woman.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
What is the protocol for a senator becoming a commissioner, and what do we call them now?
I think they're always a senator.
All right.
I have three copies of this bill. You have yours? Is anyone missing their copy of 1595? Because I have three copies. Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1595. And I have an author's amendment here that I would like to have someone move so that we can get it into the shape that we want to discuss.
We have an author's amendment?
They just passed it.
Oh, they did. Oh, okay.
No. I'd like to move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Torres Ray moves the A1 amendment, author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, members of the committee and Madam Chair. The city of Burnsville is bringing this issue to the committee. And it's about levying administrative fines and putting them onto the property tax statement of a particular property. The traditional method of in which the last measure of property code enforcement is issuing citations that can result in criminal court appearances and leads to high costs and delays in enforcement. Cities already and currently can issue, they can issue and assess properties for unpaid fees, such as for weed removal, tree trimming, and delinquent utility bills. The increasing cost of enforcement of issuing these citations, resulting in prosecution, can place a big strain on city budget and resources. The ability for cities to assess properties for unpaid property code enforcement fines would keep the property maintenance issues out of the criminal court system and allows them to be handled at an administrative level at through or under an administrative law judge level. To explain their issues here, I have Mayor Elizabeth Kautz from Burnsville and City Manager Steve Mielke from Lakeville.
All right. Welcome, Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and honorable members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Kautz, and thank you, Honorable Senator Carlson, for bringing this item before the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today to support Senate File 1595, a civil penalty and fee collection on special assessment authorization. Honorable members, as a mayor of Statutory City, I am here representing Statutory Cities and ask that you authorize and allow us to assess for unpaid fines related to property-related violations. The City of Burnsville participates in Dakota County and a countywide initiative, which is called the High Performance Partnership Committee, and this is about 13 cities within Dakota County, and we come together and we collaborate on issues that impact us. And a number of cities in the state have established administrative citations and civil penalties as an alternative method of resolving city code violations rather than criminal prosecution. Members, the City of Burnsville and our neighbors in Dakota County would like to have available to us a friendlier tool to work with our residents and business citizens on administrative citation and civil remedies that is caring and cost-effective to resolve code violations by lowering prosecution cost, providing for quicker resolution of violations, disputes, and reducing the burden of the district court system. This tool is available to charter cities, but not to statutory cities. And we have witnessed the effectiveness of this tool that is available to them and ask for the same authority for us to use this tool. Allow me to share with you examples of the type of issues that an administrative court may hear, including zoning violations and health and nuisance violations. The process is intended to be more informal and less intimidating to the alleged violator, as well as being more timely and efficient. A hearing officer who is not affiliated with the city listens to both sides of the issue and makes a determination. An administrative hearing can be optional for both parties. The proposed changes to the law would allow statutory cities to have the same tools for code enforcement as many charter cities. Providing consistency could result in the ability for cities to collaborate in this area by utilizing shared resources, such as a shared hearing officer, as envisioned by the Dakota County HIP Committee. In closing, as I mentioned earlier, we would like to have available to us this tool that is caring and will quickly resolve the issues rather than having our citizens go through the district court process, which is a criminal process for property and code violations. From an expedient viewpoint, this is beneficial not only to the violating property owner, but also for their neighbors. Imagine, if you will, living next to a property owner that has not been responsive to the citations. And as a neighbor, you see the violation and are frustrated that the process is taking so long. Imagine then if you want to have a graduation party, a wedding, or guests to your home, And you're anxious because when your guests come to your home, they will be seeing what you will be, you have been living with. And these members are real examples in our cities. Just today, coming here, two complaints of property violations. This is not unusual for me to receive these kinds of complaints on a weekly basis. We all live in communities that are aging. Mine is one of those communities. And we need the kind of tools that we can help our residents to quickly resolve these issues. So I ask you, please, help us by providing us with this tool that will help our residents quickly resolve these issues, not just the violators, but the neighbors as well. And I ask that you vote in support of 1595, this special assessment authorization. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mayor Kautz. Mr. Mielke, do you have any short additional comments to add?
Madam Chair, thank you. I will be brief. Thank you. And members, the part that I wanted to talk about was the process a little bit. The mayor from Burnsville, I think, did a very good job of explaining why this tool is important. In terms of a process, the process that most cities follow is adopting an ordinance that would enact the administrative fine process. The collection method is really what's at stake here. If we do have a home that has junk in the backyard or siding that's missing or windows that are broken, things that can be cancerous to a neighborhood over time, we already have the tools to enforce the violation. It just happens to be a criminal matter when we take it through the process. We think it is a much better system and a much faster system and can be resolved quicker than the courts can resolve it by allowing parties to choose an administrative procedure and wherein you bring in a third party unrelated to the city to hear the complaint and attempt to find a solution for that process. And administrative citations are used by some statutory cities now, but they lack the hammer at the end in terms of collection, because if you are able to establish a fine and the person chooses not to, then you're back to going to court to try and collect the fine. So what we're really looking for is something very similar to what is allowed currently for long weeds, is being able to assess that fine after it's gone through the hearing process. And also, it is possible during the process for the person to simply opt out of the administrative citation process and go to the court system. So it is clear that residents have options. This provides one that probably is cheaper for the resident to resolve and faster as well.
Senator Carlson, does the League of Cities support this bill? Do you know?
Yes. Madam Chair, yes, they do.
Okay.
And we have the League here with us also, and Metro Cities as well.
Great. Any questions? Senator Hall.
I like the bill.
Do you want to move it?
In a second, I will. since we have in front of us the best mayor in Minnesota here, my mayor, I wasn't quite sure if she was talking about me as the aging community, though. Though I know it's true. But I would like to move the bill.
So right. Any other questions? Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. Whenever you're talking about assessment against property or whatever, there's a potential constitutional issue. Is this something that is done widely and has been accepted by courts as being okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We can assess now for long weeds, but we can't assess for property maintenance issues.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kislis wanted to comment on the bill if somebody wants to give him a seat. Welcome back. Are you going to be a regular?
I didn't plan on it, but I always keep
just
an eye
on. Just state
your
name again for the record, since I probably murdered it.
Madam Chair, my name is John Kisselishan. I did have a handout here that everybody has. It's from the city of Eagan. It's listed common code requirements. It's got a bunch of little pictures on it. Mm-hmm. And
do you want someone to pass that out for you?
It's already passed out.
Oh, okay,
everybody's pile of papers. Again, Madam Chair and members, my name is John Kiselishin, and as some of you know from last week's hearing, I'm currently a newspaper owner in Anoka County. But I also previously served 4 years as mayor in the city of Roseville. I also served as a police reserve officer in my community, and during my term in office, one of the projects I worked on was code enforcement issues and how to improve the process and I think maybe achieve some of what the desire is by the testifiers here. Now, current law allows cities to assess onto property taxes for costs of doing improvements to properties, things such as tree removal, weed elimination, removal of public health and safety hazards. That's already in law. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm testifying against this bill, and I want to share the other side of the issue here, is that I see that the language that's presented here will open the door to allow cities to start assessing fines issued for anything imaginable that is related to properties. That's how I read the language, property-related issues. So I consider the potential impact of this proposal to be somewhat frightening. The proposal would allow cities to take over the role of the courts and eliminate due process rights that residents currently have. Also, I think it could potentially put an unfunded mandate upon counties who would have to process all these requests to certify all these tickets to the property tax rolls across the state of Minnesota, however many cities would happen to issue. Now, this proposal, as I see it, is written so broadly that it would apply to things like the regulation of a home-based business. That's a property-related issue. Noise complaints, firewood storage, parking in your driveway, pools, even garage sales. They're all property-related. Now, how I would see potentially the process could work under this proposal is a city could pass an ordinance simply stating that all their civil penalties related to property violations would just be simply assessed against the property. So a city employee writes an administrative ticket, you know, those type of tickets where 100% of the funds go to the city. There's no cost sharing with the county or the state. You go to City Hall and complain about your ticket. Well, there's no requirement in this bill, as I see, for an appeals process. So the city employee could just simply say, oh, we don't agree with you. If you don't want to pay the ticket, that's fine. We'll just certify it to your property taxes. You want to take this for a judge? Well, our provision doesn't provide any appeal process. You don't have a right to take it to a judge to have it appealed. You don't have any right to take it to the Office of Administrative Hearings because our proposal, our ordinance that we have within the city, doesn't spell any of that out. I mean, for example, when I was a reserve officer in Roseville, we had administrative tickets. The appeal to the administrative ticket was to the duty sergeant. That's where the appeal was. And one of the comments that was made by one of the people that was in administration was, well, if they don't like it, then they can go and take it to district court. We'll cancel the administrative ticket and we'll write a regular ticket and they can take it to district court. Under this process here, the city could just simply put it on your tax bill. Now, again, home-based businesses. Let's say you've got a wishing well planter in your front yard that a city employee doesn't like. They just ticket you, certify it to your taxes. So the thing is, in every one of these situations, it appears to me that the only option you may have, depending upon how your city ordinance is worded, is to go hire an attorney, spend $10,000, and sue the city to get your day in court. And so this bill here, if you're wealthy and you have the cash to burn, not a problem. If you're a middle-income or lower-income person, your only option is to come up with 10 grand, hire an attorney, and sue the city if you feel that your rights have been violated. Not every city, unless there's a requirement in law, is going to have a fair hearing process with an independent hearing officer. We didn't have that in Roseville years ago. So unless there's some particular statute that requires that, I don't see that in here. Another concern is if you happen to be a rental property owner. Now, since this law appears to cover all property-related issues, you could have a tenant who gets a ticket for something that's not a property maintenance issue, just a property-related issue. The tenant chooses not to pay it. It gets certified to the landlord's property taxes. The tenant moves out, and the landlord gets their surprise when they open up their tax bill next year. It's I have to say, in Roseville, we don't have problems dealing with messy properties under the current law. What we do under the current law is we simply send a letter to the person, tell them what the problem is. We meet with them. If they don't want to clean up the mess, we send city employees over there to clean it up after we've held a public hearing. We hold a public hearing before the council. People are allowed to testify, state their case, and then the council votes. We send a crew over there to clean up the property, and then we actually do something immediately for the community. We certify to the property taxes. We don't deal with all this fine type structure. We take care of the problem directly, and we do it under the current law that we have in the books.
Senator Thompson, thank you very much for your comments. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Kislishan.
Yes.
I have not had time to research this. I haven't had time to look at the issue that you're bringing up, but my assumption is, and maybe counsel can help me here, that the basis of such a proceeding would be in rem jurisdiction, that there'd be a requirement that it is tied specifically to an issue dealing with the real property, and that therefore many of the examples that have been given could never be subject to this.
That's correct.
I think that's an unfair allegation. And then secondly, if in fact this is done through the criminal process, that same person might have to have an attorney to defend in a criminal process.
That's correct.
So I think you're engaging a little hyperbole on the threats here, but tell me where I might be wrong. I mean, there's not a court in America that would say there's in rem jurisdiction related to real estate for many of the kinds of violations you've cited.
Madam Chair and Senator, all I can tell you is when I take a look at the city of Eagan and they publish their list of common code requirements, and I read through these here, all I can tell you as an average citizen here that these all appear to be property related. What by legal definition fits that, I can't tell you. But this is what I'm seeing, just using Eagan as an example. The second point of this is that concerns me is the due process. I don't see anything within the rules here that require what we would consider equal due process to going to court. For example, who is the independent hearing judge? Is the independent hearing officer the supervisor of the employee who wrote the ticket? Is there a requirement that it has to be somebody that is not connected with the particular city? Where is that law that says that has to be the case? I don't see it here. I see the potential for abuse. And yes, the second question you raised was, or the third question you raised was about the cost. If the city chooses to pursue me in court, I have the ability to go before an independent judge and defend myself. With the option B here, I would have to hire an attorney, spend $400 and some to file a motion, at least $400 and some for the motion fee, in order to sue the city, in order to attempt to protect my rights. I think it's far more difficult and complex to take legal action against a city than it is to show up in court and defend yourself in front of the judge when the city is the one that is taking the action against you.
Ms. Stengel is going to talk about the due process under the assessment law.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the special assessment law that you'll find in Chapter 429, there is a process that requires notice, a hearing, appeals process, and that's all existing under current law now. I apologize. I don't know a lot about the special assessments. It's my understanding that this bill is going to taxes, and they really do specialize in the special assessment process.
Get to see me again.
So they could probably answer more questions there, but I do know there is a process in place that will apply.
Yes. Any other comments or questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Hall?
I'd like to move Senate File 1595.
As amended?
As amended, thank you.
And we refer to the Committee on Taxes. So Senator Hall moves. Did someone else want to testify? No? Okay. Just want to make sure.
Madam Chair.
I apologize.
Okay, Chief. Just briefly, please.
Just briefly.
Yeah. Introduce yourself.
I wasn't particularly Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Lee, head of Children's Hope International, R&R Family Centers, and for APAC, the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I wasn't intending to testify on this, but after hearing the testimony, I realized that it does relate to some court cases or pending court cases that we were working on this past summer. in which case it was property related. It was a disabled elderly person who
Ms. Lee, was it in the city of St. Paul?
Does this apply only to the city of St. Paul?
No, St. Paul already has this authority.
Yeah, it does.
So we're extending the authority that St. Paul has.
We're just asking for the same powers that St. Paul has.
To other cities.
Okay, but is this just for your city, or is it for
statutory cities?
Statutory. Okay, so it would apply to the cities I'm talking about.
St. Paul is a charter city. So it already has this authority.
Yes.
Okay, so I was under the impression it would apply to the cities in, this would be in the suburban areas.
They choose to adopt this.
That's right. Right.
And that's what I'm saying is because...
That's why I just wanted to clarify.
Yes. Okay. We did have some cases where disabled elderly was unable to do some lawn mowing and the weeds or the grass popped up real fast. And so they were cited, given notice as far as penalties, incarceration, etc. Also, there was storm damage that the insurance company did not pay for yet, so the work couldn't be done. That was also part of another citation and a bunch of other things. And then the week that the lawn was mowed, the glass window got broken, and the guy was out there immediately citing them. So we had to fight to keep them out of court to get extensions of time so they could comply with the codes. And this process would immediately shoot it, the way the enforcement was doing it, would immediately shoot it into an assessment on the property. And we don't feel that this low-income disabled elderly person, you know, how would they fight it then? We as legal advocates can fight it in court, but I don't know the tax process to how we fight it there.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Senator Hall renews his motion that Senate Bill 1595 is amended, be recommended, pass, and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We had Senator Conan. Explain it to her, but I don't know, we don't have time. Senator Conan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Have this. Members, that should be right with the bill. Senator Anderson, do you want to move the author's amendment?
I don't even see it yet.
He wants to read it first. Senator Torres Ray, do you want to move the author's amendment? Senator Torres Ray moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Conan.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This bill, Senate File 1784, what it does is requires an employer to provide veterans with time off for Veterans Day. And there's a couple of reasons why this may not happen, and that would be unless providing time off would impact public health or safety, or unless it would cause the employer significant economic or operational disruption. And the employer can decide if the time off will be paid or not paid, so that's an employer's decision. An employee is required to give an employer a 30-day written notice of intent to take time off on Veterans Day, and that's, again, a written notice. The employer will notify the employee 10 days before Veterans Day if the time off is paid or not, so the employee would know that ahead of time. If an employer cannot provide time off for all employees, time off will be denied to as few as possible of the employees. And again, the reasons would be, as I listed from Section 1, that providing time off would impact public health or safety, or it would cause the employer significant economic or operational disruption. I have with me today Ms. Stephanie Vorvik, who works at the Chippewa County Veterans Service Office as the benefit coordinator for Chippewa County. And Ms. Vorovac contacted me with this idea originally, and she, of course, working in the Veterans Service Officer, has contact with veterans, many veterans, just as part of her job. And she has a few comments she would like to make to Madam Chair.
Ms. Vorovic, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Coonan. As he said, I work with veterans every day. Veterans come from all walks of life. Their parents, children, and grandparents. Their friends, neighbors, coworkers, and are an important part of our communities. As Americans, we should remember the selfless service of these great men and women. On Veterans Day, November 11th, government offices are closed, and those who work within these offices get the day off. Minnesota has approximately 245,000 veterans who are under the retirement age. Many of these veterans are working at jobs where they cannot get the day off. Both my husband and my dad are veterans, and they don't get this holiday off. This holiday is meant to honor the selfless service of these men and women. A countless number of vets cannot attend their Veterans Day programs, which are held in honor of them because they are working. Our younger generation believes that a veteran is an 85-year-old man because that's what they see when they attend their Veterans Day programs at their schools. They don't get to see our younger vets because these vets are unable to take time off from their jobs. Now is the time to give employers and businesses the opportunity to give veterans what they deserve, a day to honor them. In the words of JFK, as we express our gratitude, we must never forget the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them. So instead of talking about vets, let's do something for them.
Are there any questions from members of the committee?
I have a question.
Senator Scalzi.
Yes, do you have, thank you, Madam Chair, do you have any estimation of how many veterans are unable to take time off from work? People that you hear from, do you have a general feel for how many we're talking about?
Ms. Vorovic.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have an approximate number, I guess, of how many don't get to take a time off. I do get complaints about every year, you know, I hear about people who don't get to take the time off for Veterans Day. I know that my husband and my dad complain about not being able to take the day off. I hear from veterans that I work with that they don't get to go to the programs. I don't have an exact number for you.
Any other questions? Anyone want to move the bill? Senator Anderson? Senator Johnson? Sorry. Moves that Senate File 1784 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Jobs. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we're going to take Senator Hoffman's bill, 1792. Very non-controversial bill. Right, this is just a technical change?
Yeah.
Members, A6 is being passed out. It looks like it's just a technical change. Let's wait till it's passed out. Senator Torres Ray moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. All right. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, joining me today is Jeremy Miller, who's the Government Relations Chair of the American Massage Therapy Association Minnesota Chapter. You won't offer testimony in the interest of time. I'll say some things that are related if there are any questions pertaining to getting deeper in the weeds on this. Mr. Miller is here to help us. But, Madam Chair, all the professional associations who have expressed concerns with this bill in the past and were willing to come to the table are now either in full support of the bill or neutral. Madam Chair, this legislation has been developed over the past 8 years and would create a uniform, voluntary registration process that will provide peace of mind for clients, employers, and healthcare professionals that they are working with, vetted professionals who are bound to an enforced standard of conduct and meet certain educational standards, pass a background check as required for other healthcare professionals. This bill grants these qualified registered massage and body work therapists the title protection RMBT, just another acronym we can add to our expanding list. This proposal was reviewed by the Minnesota Council of Health Boards during a six-month process, and Madam Chair and members, their report found that there is an overall compelling state interest in regulating this industry to protect public health and safety from the actions of unqualified, improperly trained practitioners who are not currently regulated proactively by the state. Madam Chair, on average, massage and bodywork therapists work in two practice locations. I know that to be true as the massage therapist that works with my chiropractor on University Avenue. This is true for her. And they're currently required to become licensed to wait for multiple weeks to multiple months and pay fees in every city in which they intend to work. The singular state voluntary registration credential would dramatically simplify this regulatory burden and the small business professionals. This massage and bodywork therapist, those folks wishing to remain practice under 146A may continue to do so now because it does not affect 146A practices as they will be able to do now and in the future. This bill does not change those requirements under their practice massage under 146A, which are under their current city license or under their athletic trainer registration or their nurse's license or under any physical therapist license. Madam Chair, the profession of massage and bodywork therapy is practiced by more than 5,200 individuals in Minnesota, and a real need exists for state regulation. The number of actionable complaints in the 44 other states, including all of our neighbors with the state-level proactive credential, bear this out. This gives the massage and bodywork therapists a choice to stay under the status quo of the circumstances of their local mandatory license or the choice to become an RMBT, whichever works for the individual business model. This bill avoids negatively impacting unregistered practitioners the ability to practice. Any practitioner in Minnesota can choose to remain unregistered and still practice using the same techniques and even the same advertising that they use today, including the use of terms, massage, and or bodywork, so long as they do not indicate that they are state registered. Registration is not creating a slippery slope toward mandatory licensing. That's not the intent of this bill. Any sliding towards that end would require a whole new act of future legislations. So you will also find, members, in your statement in full support of Senate File 1792 from the League of Cities in your packet. They are here if you want to question them, but in the interest of time, I have chosen not to bring them to the table. So, Madam Chair, I would ask your support for this voluntary registration legislation.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And I did want to mention, since there's only Mr. Miller who's testifying in favor, although Senator Hoffman indicated there were others, and there are five testifying in opposition, I would like to ask the three people who are all from the Natural Health Legal Reform Project if between the three of you, you could agree on just having one of you testify. I would appreciate that. Mr. Miller.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I read Mr. Miller's comments, and I knew for the interest of time.
Oh, okay.
So we're good. And I just have him up here, Madam Chair, if there are any deeper questions regarding, because Mr. Miller is a professional massage therapist in the healthcare systems.
Can we look maybe at the language of the advisory council? Has our council, have you reviewed that language?
Madam Chair and members, yes, I have reviewed this section. Mm-hmm. And it meets the guidelines. It varies from the guidelines in one respect. On page 6, line 11, the choice is made that the council would not expire. And often this committee likes to see a sunset date.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And, and is there any rulemaking authority that's who is the rulemaking authority granted to?
Madam Chair and members, there is rulemaking granted to the
Board of the Minnesota Board of Nursing on page 4, beginning at line 19. And in addition, on page 5, beginning at line 1, there are some additional powers granted to the Minnesota Board of Nursing that would be part of the jurisdiction of this committee to consider.
Then my other question is this bill also, Senator Hoffman, are you going to the Health Committee then with this in terms of the policy?
Madam Chair,
Judiciary. We have you going to Judiciary.
We'll be going to
next.
Judiciary. Correct, Madam Chair, and members, Judiciary. And I just want to highlight, and Ms. James probably already knows this, but the
already?
Board,
oh, okay.
It's consistent.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
The language in sunsetting is consistent with other boards, like the Board of Nursing. That language is consistent where they typically don't have a sunset provision in there.
Okay. So you were in Health Committee last night.
Correct.
Oh, okay. And Ms. Stengel, do you want to talk about some of the other local government issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 15, starting on line 12, you'll see section 14, effect on municipal ordinances, and that's the main part of the bill that talks to local government.
Maybe you could just go through that part of the bill, Senator Hoffman or Mr. Miller, because that's part of our jurisdiction. We're talking about rulemaking, advisory committee, effect on local government.
Madam Chair, Jeremy Miller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our bill today. Again, my name is Jeremy Miller. I'm with the American Massage Therapy Association's Minnesota chapter. And it's been my privilege to be sort of leading the effort to try to get a credential here for the last 8 years. The Section 14 effect on municipal ordinances, just sort of an overarching comment, the language that we got, we worked with the League of Minnesota Cities to craft this language to make sure that it is working not just with the intention of our bill, but also with the intention of the League of Cities, and the League of Cities does have a handout, I believe, in your in the packet of paperwork. But if not, they are here to testify to that. Subdivision 1, the license authority provisions of the section preempt the licensure and regulation of a registered massage and bodywork therapist by a municipality. Currently in Minnesota, municipalities regulate individual therapists, and they also regulate massage businesses that regulate those therapists. And then there's also, of course, the opportunity for a city to regulate with a general business license that any city has to have, as well as, of course, zoning. So what this preemption language does is basically take away or take the licensure burden off of the city's plate to regulate the individual therapist. The other sections here make it clear that the city can still regulate therapists who choose not to get registered under this chapter and leave it open for the city to still regulate the business with a massage business license that the business that's employing the therapist. And it also makes it clear that there's no changes to zoning or to the general business license that would be required of any business in the city. And then Subdivision 3 just gives the city, clarifies that the municipality can prosecute violations, whether by a registered therapist or an unregistered therapist, which is, of course, hopefully goes without saying, but just to make it, you know, perfectly clear in the statute that we're not trying to take that away. So the only thing that this does for a registered massage and bodywork therapist who has the state credential, they would be exempted from the individual therapist city license, which is exactly what the League of Cities position is, that they would like the state to take over. Our position is that the therapists, if they've gotten the credential from the state, shouldn't be double regulated. So we're also, of course, 100% in favor of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So why don't we move on to the testimony then and invite Barbara York to come forward. Mm-hmm. And yes. And why don't we also ask Marie Traver to come forward. And I have to ask you that because you already, the Health Committee already approved this bill, that you please join us, that you should limit your comments to on the Advisory Council, the Rulemaking Authority, and Section 14, the Municipal Ordinance Section. Those are under our jurisdiction.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the other section? And the added duties of the board.
I'm sorry, I missed that last part.
Added duties of the, it's the Board of Nursing, right. Added duties of the Board of Nursing.
Section 6.
Section 6.
Madam Chair, my name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. I've been working with massage bills over the years since 1987, and I have been representing practitioners as well as the public. We've worked with other groups, the Natural Health Group that will be testifying here as well, in looking for something that works for the consumer and for the practitioner. We pass laws for that factor. We've passed laws that protect the consumer, and many of the very prohibited conducts factors in this bill is covered under the 146A, which we passed in 2000. What we found is a very grave consideration of what happens with cities as this is presented as a voluntary bill. That's with a two-year grandfathering clause. The school that I went to, and Marie was the founder of that school, no longer exists. I took the 1,000-hour accreditation that was offered at that time. Many people took lesser hours. If they don't register during this grandparenting clause, they will never be able to qualify for the registration without huge amounts of money. And what we're considering here is the lack of evidence of harm all these years for the supposedly undereducated but very experienced practitioners who are out there. So they're being penalized because they will not be treated equally under this law. And it creates an unequal treatment for the registered and unregistered. One of the things, we heard this bill was authored last Tuesday. We heard this, we were here on Thursday and heard that there would be a hearing on Monday. We have scrambled. We've talked to many of you in the past about what this is really about. And this is why these bills have never passed, because when we're able to really have the chance, and we're volunteers, we're not lobbyists. I'm here. I've lost money this week because I have canceled clients, so I could be here to testify. It's not just for myself. I qualify at this time. But if my city decides to have this registered and I didn't go and do the voluntary part of it, it suddenly is mandatory. I'll tell you, I was a nurse's aide to begin with, and then I became a first aid instructor, and I was one of the first instructors teaching CPR. I don't want to learn CPR. I do not want to have that obligation on me. I think it's dangerous for massage therapists who will rarely get to use this, and yet that's what it's going to require of me. The people who are presenting this bill own schools, own the professional liability insurance, benefit from it. They had an argument in the last time this bill was heard in 2010. That was where the health board study in 2009 that they were referring to, that was for that bill, and it got tabled because it didn't answer the questions. I'm sitting here begging that you not pass this bill because it's unnecessary. But I'm also sitting here in grief because I know how many people, part-time people who are making ends meet, will be hurt for the benefit of the schools and the national organizations who have had a major investment to see this passed, but not the practitioners and not the citizens of this state who have always shown up and been against these bills.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for your comments, Ms. York. Ms. Traver.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Marie Traver, and as Barbara said, I was the co-founder of and instructor at the Minneapolis School of Massage, which started way back, as you can tell by my gray hair, in 1975. Our school was accredited in 1994, and we were the very first school in the state. We have many, many massage therapists out there, as Barbara talked about, that we'll be having to really, this will pose a problem for them, because in our early years, we did not teach lengthy classes. And many of these students and practitioners that are out there are working and have been working. As myself, I've worked for 32 years at the downtown YWCA, and I am presently working. And I have never encountered any injury to anyone or any of my alumni that I'm aware of. So I'm hoping that this bill, that you will listen to what Barbara had to say and take it under consideration.
Any questions for these two witnesses?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one question is, how many people, I mean, it sounds like you don't, you, I didn't catch your last name, but you said that you don't recall.
Ms. York and Ms. Traver.
Ms. Traver.
The last speaker?
Yes.
Traver.
Traver?
On the
agenda. Ms. Traver, you've said that you don't recall or don't know of anybody that's been harmed or had any problem. Is there anybody that from the Office of Complementary and Alternative Practice under the Department of Health, are there any statistics that show that there have been people that have been harmed by the present day?
No. Mr. Miller, did you have any information on that?
I do.
Okay, Ms. Traver, and maybe you could let him sit here again. Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we presented information to the Minnesota Council of Health Boards in 2009 for their basically sunrise review of the legislation that is before you. The process that this legislature set up to evaluate those very questions, the Council of Health Boards came back with a report that said that the public health and safety is at significant risk by not regulating this profession based on the materials that we provided to them. I'm happy to provide that information to you if you're interested or to anybody else. There are cases of harm from this profession. It's not, certainly we acknowledge that massage therapy is not as risky as, say, you know, the work that a surgeon does or a pharmacist or, you know, a chiropractor even. But to say that there's less risk is not the same as saying that there's no risk.
And it's a continuum. I mean, this is registration. Mm-hmm. And so if there was a more risk involved, there would be certification. And then ultimately, if there's more risk involved, it's licensing. And I personally think that we have to be very careful that really if there's only a very significant health risk, do we go to licensing? Because many of these professions, we can protect the public through certification or through registration.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Miller, in this bill that we're having proposed for to us, you're saying the initial registration is $285 and the school approval is $300. What is today's cost to a massage therapist that they have to pay to their local municipality? Well, how does that figure into? I mean, and what I'm concerned about is you're having someone pay a certain amount. Now you're going to have another, and you're going to have two sets of dynamics, and you're going to say, well, this person paid this much money, this person paid this much money, this person must be more qualified than this person here. And I'm just wondering what if you can give me some idea what today's massage therapists pay to the municipality.
You're talking about pay fees to municipalities?
Whatever the municipality requires.
Okay, Mr. Miller.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the city municipality ordinances that require an individual massage therapist to get a city license, are, unfortunately, this is part of the problem, is they're all over the board. One city in Richfield, I believe it's $75 where I live. If you go up the road to Edina, it's $150. If you go, so if a practitioner works in multiple locations, as Senator Hoffman mentioned, many massage therapists work in multiple locations in multiple clinics. They'll work in one location 2 days a week and another location 3 days a week, and have a client that they go to three times a month, and all in different cities. And each city that the therapist goes to, they oftentimes will have to get a license in each one of those cities. And so if a therapist is working in just one location and that's the only place they ever work and ever want to work, and that location is less than the fee that this credential would be, assessing, that therapist can choose not to get registered. If a therapist, however, is going to multiple locations, it often, in many cases, is going to be a really easy decision because they're paying hundreds of dollars in some cases to get this one city license. And then if they go to other locations, it's another $75 or $100 or $150 to get each of those city licenses. And so to pay one fee to the state, have one background check, have one credential to be able to work wherever clients call them or wherever employers want to hire them, is going to make it very much easier for employees and therapists and the employers who want to put them to work to provide access to care for clients.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Miller, that is a choice.
It is 100% voluntary at the state level, yes.
I mean, it's a choice for them to work in Edina and Richfield and wherever they want to, and it's a choice of understanding that this is what they'll have to pay to work in this city. And so that's a freedom of choice.
It is. Okay. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I asked for a representative from one representative from the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. Did you choose your person?
Diane Miller is not here today, so.
Oh, okay. So then it's just between Greg Schmidt and Leo Cashman. Okay. Please. And thank you very much, Ms. York, for your testimony.
I did have some. Madam Chair, there were some things that I wanted to point out about what had been said about the multiple municipalities.
Well, Ms. York, if someone has asked a question of you, then you could respond with that. But I think you did have quite a long time to testify. I know I went to the bathroom and back, and you were still talking.
That was a long time.
I
did have a question that I've been trying to get clarified, and I just want to make sure. This issue around multiple municipalities, I know that when I talk to the folks in the city of Minneapolis, it appears that they license facilities but not practitioners. So it just kind of depends on what city you go to. And I think that I just wanted to get that on the record because that had been a sticking point for me as I think about how do we do this. The city of Minneapolis is, in particular, is looking at this through a trafficking lens and the idea of really kind of enforcing that. I'm not necessarily saying this bill doesn't kind of care about that, but there's some interplay between that I want to make sure the committee understands relative to the normal licensing process of making sure a practitioner is competent versus also the added issue of what we've been seeing around sex trafficking, Backpage.com, and all of that kind of stuff. So I just want to make sure that we, because that has never really been totally clear to me, how do we continue to enforce the public safety from a sex trafficking point of view, in addition to understanding how do we license people to ensure that they're competent in their practice.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, you bring up Minneapolis, and it just so happens there is a Minneapolis representative right here in this room. And Madam Chair, I'd like to bring her up to discuss the question that he has regarding the licensing piece and how it sounds to me like, Senator Hayden, Madam Chair, that you talk about how the law enforcement side of things to making sure things happen.
Okay,
it would
please,
be so kind.
Please join us to respond to Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Melissa Lesh. I'm a government relations representative with the City of Minneapolis, and Senator Hayden, I think, accurately described how the City of Minneapolis has managed this these businesses in this situation. Up until recently, the city did not regulate massage businesses separately from just a regular business license. And I believe it was about 6 months ago we moved ahead with a new type of business license that was, as Senator Hayden mentioned, for the facility and not for the practitioner. And it really was our work around sex trafficking that was the impetus for wanting to have a different type of a lens that we were looking at these particular types of businesses within the city. But again, that really was for the establishment and not for the practitioner. So we are really comfortable with the language and the legislation that's before you, and we think it works for us and it works for a lot of other cities as well.
Thank you. All right, is this Mr. Cashman or Mr. Schmidt?
Yes.
Mr. Cashman.
Mr. Cashman.
Okay.
My name is Leo Cashman, and I am a president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project, and also am a treasurer of National Health Freedom Action, Diane Miller's organization that she is public policy director for. And Diane Miller regrets that she could not be here to testify, but I have a brief statement of some key remarks that represent our position, too. So both the national organization and the Minnesota Health Freedom Organization completely agree in the statement of opposition to Senate File 1792. First of all, this registration bill, there is no constitutional basis to register massage and bodywork therapists in Minnesota under Chapter 214 law listing the criteria for regulating professions. So, and that criteria is imminent risk of harm. So it's just not a theoretical possibility of harm, but more of an imminent risk. And so this is a very serious point. As you all have heard, Minnesota already regulates massage therapy and body workers under Chapter 146A. And so that ensures that
Mr.
consumer.
Cashman, I'm yes. really apologize to interrupt you, and I did a lot of. I was very lenient with the previous witnesses, even though I had already told them that our jurisdiction. This bill has already been approved by the Health Committee.
I understand.
We are only looking at the Advisory Council, the rulemaking, municipal ordinance, and the added duties of the Board of Nursing. So it's real.
Okay.
We're really very technical committee here at this point. We're not really looking at the policy, which has already been approved by the appropriate committee.
I understand that. Okay, well, I will try to hone in on the things you're interested in. Attorney Miller did believe that the constitutional issue was under your purview.
No, that would be Judiciary Committee, if at all.
Okay, thank you. And so we are concerned about the unequal treatment of the registered versus the unregistered practitioners with regard to city regulation. And the bill contains language preventing cities from regulating and licensing the registered practitioners, but the bill does not prevent the cities from regulating Minnesota 146A practitioners. So this inequality concerns us, and so we conceivably cities could just depend on state regulation, state registration, and only allow state registered practitioners to work in their municipalities. So this could be de facto mandatory mm-hmm. registration for people wanting to practice in certain cities. And so this is what we talk about as the slippery slope towards mandatory requirement for this registration. So, and this unequal treatment of registered versus unregistered would jeopardize the practices of thousands of small business healing practitioners who are willing to abide by all municipal laws but have no intent going to special schools or paying the fees for the registration and who are currently working under 146A. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cashman. Any questions from members of the committee? Someone like to move the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
I'd like to move Senate File 1792. Was that amended?
Yes,
amended.
It was. Mm-hmm.
And is that referred to?
Judiciary. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 1792 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members
thank
of the
you,
committee,
Senator
thank
Hoffman.
You.
Senator Dahl, two more quick bills and we'll be done. I hope they're quick. Me too.
Madam Chair and committee members, I think we can be fairly quick here. This is, I do have an A1 amendment to get the bill in the order I would like it to
we
be
have
in.
That amendment in our packet. Senator Dahl moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dahl.
And the A1 amendment really is just regarding the effective date. We need to allow the township to, as you can read there, to get their house in order before they actually can enact what's in the legislation. What the legislation, Senate File 1958, and I can be very brief, and we have Terry Mace here, one of the chair of the Helena Township. He can answer any questions if you have any. But we're really changing a number, allowing for more connections in the Cedar the Cedar Lake area, Water and Sanitary District, to hook up to New Prague, basically. And then the other section, too, is, and New Prague is on board with that, and the other section here, too, is once all bills are paid, the township wondered if they had the authority or what authority they had to actually do with the leftover funds that might be available in that particular instance. So I don't know if you have any questions or if Terry Mace want to make a comment
Mr. Mace,
or two.
Please share some details with us.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Senate members. I guess the quickest and easiest explanation is the township is not very good. We are not a water treatment facility, and that's what this is. It's for 39 homes. We have a very close and easy access to add on to the Cedar Lake Sewer Water District by adding a pipe of 400 feet. The changing of the number is requested by the city of New Prague versus having just a random wide open type thing that you could add in any number of homes later on. We have okay from the city of New Prague, the sewer district, Met Council, Scott County, and Helena Township. The funds that what we have is 8 acres of land where the mound systems are for the sewer district, and we inherited that through the process of being designated as the operator of this by Scott County. They did not want the sewer district to be operated by an association because they can fail and be very unorganized. So we now have this land. With selling the land, we would like to use that to be able to retrofit the homes that are already in that development to adapt them to the Cedar Lake Sewer District. And that is, in talking to our township lawyer, it was brought to our attention that when that land would be sold, that's then considered township money, and township money cannot be used in the assistance of residential properties.
Thank you, Chair Mace. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Dahl, this has to go to the Tax Committee.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 1958 as amended to be passed and moved on to the Tax Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. And
thank
then
you very
Senator
much.
Johnson.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson, looks like you have an author's amendment in the packet.
Yes.
Senator Johnson moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Johnson.
Members, this bill was brought to me by the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Cosmetology, Gina Suss, sitting next to me, asking for an expansion of the board and taking care of some other language that needs to be updated. And I would ask Gina to give you an assessment of this
Ms. Stouse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening. My name is Gina Stouse, and I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Board of Cosmetologists Examiners. As a part of the unsession, this bill will correct outdated, duplicated, inconsistent statutory language, as well as provide balance to the board. This bill is important, as inconsistent law can create confusion for licensees and the public. Further, it is important for the health and safety of the public and for our licensees to ensure each profession is represented on the board in order to gain full perspective on issues that the board is presented with. The bill has no known opponents and will increase board membership from 4 to 7, and again, fix outdated statutory language relating to the board definitions and licensing action. The board will have no fiscal impact, as the board is able to absorb the cost in increasing the memberships from 4 to 7. I can go through section by section if the chair and the members would like, or I can stop there.
I think the explanation by Council James is pretty clear in the section by section. Do any members have any questions? Except for expanding their board, I think it's pretty much a housekeeping bill. Is that correct? Would that be, you'd say that's the major thing, is expanding your board?
Madam Chair, the big part of the bill is changing it from 4 to 7, but in regards to a fiscal change, it's not a big change, and again, we can absorb the cost.
And what is the Section 15? What's the repealer?
The repealer is back in 2010 when the Board of Barber and Cosmetologist Examiner split up. It was this section of law was only put in the cosmetology piece, which was to provide a customer service access point for feedback on the board and to report to the committees that oversee our board, such as this one, a report of our customer service activities. We have done this for the last several years, and we send a letter. It's a report is very limited in scope. It's not wide-ranging. And we submit it to the legislative library as well, and we've never hear one comment or feedback, considering the language is feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So we just felt that it was unnecessary and would like to remove it.
And what's this section? Where'd this come from? Adopt rules to permit felons to be licensed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, when the board used to be housed under the Department of Commerce, so through the evolution of the Board of Cosmetology, some laws got placed into our statutes that maybe Commerce had authority of, and this would be one of them. So we follow Minnesota. Let me grab my notes here. We follow Minnesota statute for the Criminal Rehabilitation Act, which is Minnesota Statute 364, in licensing of felons. We have no specific rules that actually allow us to deny a license.
Okay.
And we have a facility in Shakopee.
Okay.
Women's right. Prison.
Any questions from members of the committee? All right, then, Senator Johnson.
I move that this bill be recommended to pass as amended and referred to
the floor.
The floor.